All right, good morning. This last matter on our oral calendar here today is William Jepson is trustee for the heirs and next of kin of Eric Parker, Dean, versus Pope County et al. Council's aware of our, please be seated. Yeah, we'll get you some. Could you get him some water there, please, Joe? Council's aware that on both sides need some water, apparently.
It's hot in here.
It's hot in here, and it's been a thirsty morning. Yeah, we don't want to disadvantage you by the timing of your arguments here today. Just preliminarily, before you start, I'll get you your water, but you know you each have 15 minutes for your preliminary arguments, and Council for Appellant will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Are you going to be splitting your time here at all today, Council?
No.
All right. And then when you begin your arguments, once we get you some water, please identify yourselves for the record. So let's get your water pitchers filled up before we get started. Yeah, for a minute there, I thought I felt some cool air blowing in here, but they apparently have turned it off again.
May it please the court. Good morning.
Hold on 1 second. We'll get our timekeeper going here.
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize.
And you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. My name is Paul Peterson, and together with Anu Chudazama and William Harper of the firm Harper & Peterson, we are proud to stand here today and represent William Jepson, the trustee for the heirs and next of kin of the late Eric Dean. This case presents what appears and what we believe strongly to be an issue of first impression, and that is whether in the area of liability for caseworkers and social workers working in the area of child protection, whether we call it the RMMA or the CARA, and it's been an interchangeable statutory description, whether that statute, by virtue of two roles that it plays, one is outlining a series of directions to counties on how to handle these types of cases and reports and complaints, and two, by a specific immunity provision, whether or not that statutory system abrogates common law immunity in the form of official immunity and, by extension, vicarious official immunity in the area of liability for a claim under the statute. We presented this case to the district court on presented this issue on two occasions. One, we raised it as a Rule 12B motion for dismissal that procedurally came up before this court to see if it was ripe for appeal at that time. It was determined it was not. Proceedings occurred in the district court. Eventually, a motion for summary judgment was brought by the defense, and that motion was granted. And while the court in its two orders gave acknowledgement or lip service to the argument or to the position and the legal reality that statutory systems prepared and put in place by the legislature can and do abrogate common law in two methods. One is by express abrogation. That is, the legislature expressly states, we abrogate the common law with this statute. But the second and equally important way that it can be abrogated is by necessary implication.
You're not arguing express
We are not. And I think to comment on the respondent's argument both below and here, they and the district court did the same thing, I think, following that argument. They recognize the rule, but then they don't apply it. They say it's not expressly abrogated, therefore, and the analysis goes on. And so we submit this case so far, no court has analyzed the issue we've presented. It simply has applied the common law immunities and dismissed the case. And by doing that, there was also, there's a secondary issue. There's three issues. The first is the abrogation issue and the coordination of the common law immunities and the statutory system established by the Minnesota legislature. The second issue is, did the district court err in applying vicarious statutory immunity under Minnesota Statutes 46603 Subdivision 6, which protects operational level types of decision making? And finally, the district court determined that there was insufficient evidence of proximate cause so that a claim could not go forward, even if the immunities were not applied in the manner in which the district court applied it. So and I will take those in the order of the abrogation first.
Great. Let's turn to that. So as I understand I'm just trying to understand, when you presented what the issue was, you said two things, whether the RMMA, by outlining a series of directions to counties and by a specific immunity provision, abrogates official immunity. When I look at your brief, I just want to make sure I understand the scope of your argument. When I look at your brief seems to be focused on paragraph Roman 1, whether subdivision 4B of the RMMA abrogates common law official immunity. Is there a separate argument that you're making? Your brief seems very focused on the immunities under subdivision 4B.
By discussing the two parts of the statute, I think it's important. Your reading is correct that we are focused on the immunities in 4B, but the immunities in 4B are informed by subdivisions 10 and 11. And subdivisions 10 and 11 provide a series of directions. The defense calls them guidelines. And so it's important because the legislature is putting in place a series of instructions, directions, mandates, and some guidelines. Some of it acknowledge that there's going to be some give and take and there's some choices within what is going on. And then the legislature says, okay, now that we've given you those, now that we've outlined this in the statute, we are now saying that when it comes to the statute, and specifically subdivisions 10 and 11, there will be immunity if the county can show two things and the county employee can show two things. One, that they acted in good faith, and two, that they acted with due care. And so that is, and it makes sense when you look at the legislative program. And it's important, from 1974 to the present time, the legislature has revisited this statute a number of times. And every time they've revisited it, they've put more and more in trying to address the issues and problems that arise in this area when counties are carrying out their child protection duties.
So at what point, when you talked about the SLD case in your reply brief, I think, yes, in particular, so I think the argument about SLD is, you know, it discussed official immunity. It also discussed in footnotes, perhaps only, RMMA immunity. One could read that as suggesting that they coexist, but you're saying, well, that's only because no one raised the issue, I presume. But I think you also talk about that the RMMA immunity was different at that time. At what point do you believe the RMMA, in its evolution, abrogated the common law?
Depending on the situation, and looking at 10 and 11, it's kind of hard to answer in the abstract because it will be case specific. Okay, sometimes the statute may not be invoked until a certain point in time. And we think that Kranz really dealt with one issue of one complaint that came in, and the county decided it was not going to deem it a report under the statute. Under the version of the RMMA that exists in 10 and 11, it's very clear that the legislature then now, on the statute that governs our case, now says that from the moment the complaint comes in, RMMA is applying because it gives instructions on how to do it. You shall open an investigation. You shall move forward in this manner, and it's taking over.
So, is your reading of SLD then that it didn't abrogate official immunity at that time, the RMMA, by virtue of the way it was written? Because that seems to be not a, depending on the whether it abrogates the common law, would I think be dependent on looking at the statute and the common law in every case.
And I have not undergone that task of looking at the version of the statute exactly under Kranz and the facts that were presented. What I think if we did, my suggestion would be that had someone argued the abrogation issue, it it might that there's a very good chance that even under different language, abrogation should have been determined to be occurring and to be by necessary implication.
Okay.
And so, in Kranz, what they said is we get this one report, the supervisors review it with the social worker, and the supervisors say, we don't think this rises to the level of a report. And Kranz said that is official immunity. We're going to apply official immunity to that decision. But Kranz didn't dispose of the case. Kranz also had an allegation that the social worker did not give complete information. I don't remember if it was complete or accurate or both. And so Kranz is deciding that case in the context of it's going to be going forward. It's going to exist. And so not only did it not deal with the abrogation question at all, when it gets to footnote 4, it's unclear whether it's talking about its decision to apply official immunity to the report, non-report issue, or whether it's talking about its decision to not find any immunity when it comes to the social worker conveying information. And so that's why, in candor, we've struggled with Kranz on how it fits into this whole picture. And when we look at the current version of the statute and we look at the immunities as they exist and we look at the common law under our facts, we don't think Kranz is very enlightening or helpful to the analysis, and because it is at a different point in time with subdivisions 10 and 11 and subdivision 4B all being in a different format, we think it has limited to no precedential value on the decision that needs to be made here today.
So as I understand your argument, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that your argument is that official immunity will always swallow the RMMA immunity. RMMA immunity will always fit within a broader umbrella of official immunity, so that can't be what the legislature intended. By necessary implication, it meant to establish that and only that as the immunity and abrogate the official immunity.
The argument, and maybe to help with understanding how we're looking at it, I think a good comparison for this court to use as a guide for how to go through this kind of an issue is the State v. Ballou versus City of Moundsview, which was...
Before we get there, though, okay. Can I ask you one question?
Sure.
Why is it that the RMMA immunity necessarily is always within official immunity? And I'll have the same question for opposing counsel, too, if there's something else. Is there any RMA immunity that exists outside of official immunity? Could there not be, in other words, ministerial duty, a claim based on a ministerial duty that would not qualify for official immunity but might qualify for RMMA immunity?
Yes, and I think a case, the Olson versus Ramsey County case, is somewhat interesting there because there was a whole plan development with respect to a specific case that Justice Simonette said, okay, this one involves enough operational level planning, we're going to use 466.03 subdivision 6. But it was interesting, Justice Simonette says in that opinion, the implementation of the plan, that's not discretionary, that's ministerial. And so it's you're right in the various contexts. And so let's look at Kranz for a moment. In this case, there were 12 complaints, 7 of which were deemed to be basically I forget the phrasing they used, but they were ruled out or they were so arguably they were not considered a report. Okay, under Kranz, you might say, okay, that's discretionary, you can't do that. But there's 5 that are ruled in. And 2 of which go to the voluntary program, and 3 of which are subject to investigation. There's been no analysis below of whether or not due care was used, whether it's ministerial or not. And we were arguing, if you apply the immunity in a blanket fashion, you know, our main argument is in this case, none of the decisions are entitled to official immunity, not because of a discretionary versus non-discretionary or discretionary versus ministerial analysis, but because we're talking about statutory direction from the legislature, and the legislature said you're going to have to use due care. And earlier you said how do these coexist or not coexist? There's 2 words to that, due care. When you enter due care into the analysis, there's no ability to kind of match that with anything in the common law official immunity. Common law official immunity, it's an absence of malice. If you can demonstrate malice, then you can do it. but there's no negligence standard involved there. That's where Ballew is interesting, because it took the Human Rights Act and compared it to the official immunity, and it said, you know, the malice standard and the Human Rights Act requirement of discriminatory intent, those match up. So we don't have abrogation by implication because they can coexist. Here, with this type of claim, there's no way when due care, we never get to the question of due care that the legislature required. And it's interesting, if you match up the due care requirement under the RMMA with 46603 subdivision 5, which is the general immunity for a municipality for employees that are carrying out a statute, the due care requirement is in subdivision 5. And under the BOOP decision, that it said that subdivision 5, due care, imposes a negligence standard, and it's a jury question. And so what we're looking at here is a legislature that's actually made a decision to involve itself in how do you carry out your duties, county? How do you protect these children?
But how are those not supplementing the common law? And that's one question. The second question I have for you is, going back to the argument that the common law swallows the RMMA statute, how does the common law cover the criminal immunity that's provided under the RMMA?
As far as the...
Because I don't think the common law applies to criminal...
No, so then it would just be the statutory, and if they can demonstrate good faith and due care, I think they would...
So why isn't that supplementing the common law then?
Well, in your example, you said the common law doesn't apply. The common law immunities don't apply to criminal acts.
Right.
Okay. So if the common law immunities don't apply in the first place, you're left only with the statute. Here.
Right. Why isn't the RMMA then supplementing and adding to what the common law doesn't apply? In other words, your argument is the common law swallows the RMMA, but how can it swallow when it doesn't even apply to criminal liability?
Well, okay, I didn't quite understand your question. I do better now, so hopefully I'll answer it a little more directly and better. Our position is, if you allow the application of the discretion of the official immunity, then it will swallow. Okay, our argument here today is the statute, by necessary implication, says, you know, in this area, we're not going to courts. We don't want you to apply official immunity. We want to take control of this area. We as a legislature, we've put out some requirements, we've put out some direction, we've put out some shall. If you read subdivisions 10 and 11, I see I'm out of time. May I finish my answer?
Your answer.
All right. When you look at subdivisions 10 and 11, the word shall appears many, many times with respect to how these county workers are supposed to carry out their duties when it comes to protecting children. In shall and start an investigation, shall look at this, do that. It's giving a lot of direction. And so the necessary implication standard requires that, much kind of like in the criminal matter where malice would always be found in some sort of criminal intent situation, so you don't have common law immunities, and you don't have them, I think, just in general on the criminal. But here we're saying it only swallows it if we don't follow what the legislature implied, which is the legislature saying, courts, this one's our area. We're taking over in this one. And they're in a good position to do so because they can do fact-finding. They can have hearings. They can hear from the different constituencies. And so they've set out a broad public policy, which is to protect children. They didn't put in there, you know, that they want to protect county workers, but the due care requirement and the good faith requirement does protect county workers, and consistent with our overall statutory system of immunity and liability when it comes to a legislature saying, this is the statute that we'll control.
All right, thank you, Mr. Peterson. You. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Sorry, excuse me.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jim Andreen. I represent Polk County and its social workers in this case. I want to make sure that one thing is very clear here. What the appellant is arguing is that official immunity should never apply in a case like this. He is not saying that the district court applied it improperly. In other words, that's not the function, or it's not an issue in this case, on whether these social workers are entitled to official immunity unless this court decides to abrogate official immunity. As counsel and the court have already discussed, that has to be done by necessary implication. The cases that the plaintiff or the appellant has cited in this tell us what necessary implication is. The abrogating the common law is attorney's fees statute. At common law, there is no right to attorney's fees. There are various statutes that set out when you can get attorney's fees. That, by necessary implication, abrogates the common law.
I think this is closest to the Civil Damages Act case. Why is this any different from that, where necessary abrogation was found? Because the legislature did legislate in the area, and the Supreme Court decided that vicarious immunity, I think, was abrogated, right?
I'm not following you.
I think that the strongest case of necessary implication abrogation was that related to the Civil Damages Act.
The Dram Shop Act or the Wrongful
right.
Death Statute?
Oh, maybe I'm making a mistake.
The Wrongful Death Statute, at common law, the cause of action died.
The Urban case.
I'm sorry?
Urban versus American Legion.
Okay. And I'm unclear what the question is.
Well, then we don't need to focus on it. I was wondering how this is distinguishable from Urban versus American League.
Okay, and I'm unclear what the issue is.
Okay, that's fine.
The other case is the wrongful death statute, where there was no claim after a person died. The legislature came in and made a claim. The collateral source rule was a common law. Double recovery allowance, where the legislature came in and said, no, you can't do that. They never expressly said that. As counsel correctly stated, to expressly abrogate a common law, the statute has to say, we hereby expressly abrogate common law. The ADA amendments, for example, expressly abrogated three U.S. Supreme Court decisions. So the concept of necessary abrogation, which is disfavored in the law, has to come about when it's very obvious. Now, the difference here is that the legislature added immunities to an existing scheme of immunities.
So in what situation would the RMMA provide immunity that is not provided by official immunity? How is it additive?
If there is a ministerial action, not discretionary, then if the person is not going to be able to get official immunity. And by the way, there's no question here that these are all discretionary actions entitled to official immunity. But if there is a ministerial action, if that person was acting with good faith and due care, then they would be entitled to the RMMA immunity. Kind of a belt and suspenders type of thing, which I think all of these schemes of immunities are. They're all there for a different purpose, perhaps a different factual scenario. I would point out that there's two types of immunities that I don't know that counsel had talked about. The first immunity is due care and good faith. The other one is the due care and following subdivisions 10, H, I, and J. That all came about with the Scott County case. As you will recall, the prosecutor and the law enforcement put words into children's mouths, didn't provide an investigation properly. H, I, and J came about because they weren't doing it properly. But I will point out to you that in this case, there is a world of discretion, unlike what counsel has discussed, in all of these claims. For example,
well, how is there discretion in the mandatory cross-report? I mean, it says they shall cross-report to law enforcement. That seems pretty ministerial to me.
Yes, Your Honor, I agree. In that case, in that instance, the court has stated, the district court has stated, there's no causation that would have made any difference, and there is no causation there. There's no evidence that would have made any difference because The only evidence on it is the affidavit of Nicole Names, who states that the sheriff's office did not want cross-reporting because the expertise in child abuse investigation lay with the Department of Human Services, not with the sheriff's office. And so to that extent, then cross-reporting wouldn't have caused any issues because the sheriff's office would have taken no action anyway.
Did you argue before or suggest before that that failure to cross-report could also be protected under the immunities of the RMMA?
I argued that they could be protected under statutory discretionary immunity. That is a discretionary policy-making decision of the county, and I would consider that as well, because we do have a statutory discretionary immunity claim here as well. If you think about it.
So the county can adopt a policy that ignores a clear mandate of the legislature?
I believe they can.
And be protected from that?
I believe it can, because the statute.
I think the legislature might disagree with that.
The statutory discretionary immunity doesn't allow for a discussion like official immunity as to the good faith standard. By the way, the good faith standard or the malice standard is not simply malice or good faith, which it does make it different from that. It means the willful violation of a known law or statute. So that would take that action out of official immunity and place it in statutory discretionary immunity. But to have the appellant say it, statutory discretionary immunity, 466.03 subdivision 6, has now been abrogated somehow by the RMMA. I will point out two things that are important, that this court and the Supreme Court have visited these statutes over and over again, and the legislature has revisited this statute over and over again. It has never suggested, either the courts or the legislature, that these immunities are somehow in conflict. And in fact, as Your Honors mentioned, in the SLD Kranz case, they were actually being worked or read together, official immunity in the main body, RMMA immunity in the footnotes.
Well, counsel, to that point, has there been any case that has specifically raised the issue that the RMMA abrogates the common law?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor.
Okay. So the issue may not have been directly raised and addressed by any court prior to this case then.
I think I get this question a lot in my career. I think because it's so obvious that it shouldn't, because of these cases that have always dealt with this immunity the same way, and because of what I said earlier, in that this isn't a case where there is a clear common law direction going this way, for instance, in attorney's fees, or for instance, the wrongful death statute, and the legislature comes in and goes this way, directly. That's what necessary implication means. That's why the courts have said that that you should proceed with extreme caution when thinking you are going to look at a statute and say, well, that abrogates the common law official or common law immunities.
Can I ask, I have a couple questions. So relative to the not reporting to law enforcement, the district court ultimately disposed of it on the basis of the merits and the absence of evidence. It decided on causation. In your brief, you said that the court held that Pope County and the social workers are entitled to immunity under the RMMA. Where? And is that relative to, I didn't actually see that. I saw the discussion of the RMMA immunity in connection with the failure to report, but I don't actually see a conclusion by the district court.
I think that was poorly worded. The subdivision 3 mandate to report to law enforcement is different than the RMMA. I don't think we meant to suggests that the court, because if you read the court's opinion, it's pretty clear that the court says there are issues of fact with
right.
the RMMA immunity.
Okay.
So that might have been a poorly worded section of our brief, and I apologize.
And that's okay. And then with respect to the discretionary immunity, tell me how, I mean, if social workers have screening guidelines and they're making decisions under the screening guidelines, why isn't that implementing policy that's already established, as opposed to, I mean, they don't have, I think, the authority to decide, well, we can't really quite afford it, so we're not going to pursue this one, and so it's not, like, financial or other. It doesn't, it feels different for me than discretionary immunity, which I could see applying to the establishment of the screening guidelines, for example.
Well, I think what you have to take is the case as a whole, and the screening that it did, and its interpretation of the screening guidelines, the county's interpretation of screening guidelines as a whole. For instance, if this exists, then we don't screen it in. If this exists, we do screen it in, and that sort of thing.
But what's the difference between official immunity? I mean, it seemed like the district court referred to the same type of conduct, and it doesn't matter. I know this is de novo, but as official immunity and discretionary immunity, and I don't really... Which conduct went to official immunity, in your view, as opposed to the conduct that was covered by discretionary immunity?
Well, I think there are overlapping immunities in this case. And what the district court did specifically say with statutory immunity was the screening decisions, the way that the county implemented its policy versus the DHS policy to decide how to proceed with screening decisions. I will show you, I will tell you, if you look in these statutes and these policies, the word shall comes up a lot. Really quickly, I just wanted to point out one piece of it, which occurs over and over and over again. And that is under subdivision H, for example, the local welfare agency shall collect available and relevant information to determine, et cetera, et cetera. And these are all, H, I, and J, by the way, are only investigations and assessments, not screening decisions, but they're similar language as well. And the question is whether this is discretionary or not. In the assessments, what is the relevant information? What is the complete information? Isn't spelled out. That's experience and judgment or official immunity. In the screening guidelines, it's similar language, but the county as a whole, the child protection team as a whole, makes those decisions on what to screen in and what to screen out, interpreting the DHS guidelines. So it's more of a policy-making activity. So I think that's a long way to answer that question. I want to point out, I think we've really run over a lot of the law, but I do want to point out that these immunities are very important to the social workers. The due care and good faith type of claim is always going to be a jury question. Those are subjective discussion points. Official immunity is always a question of law. Now, there are some facts that you have to filter, and if there are questions of facts, you can make that decision. But the point of the official immunity and the statutory discretionary immunity is to keep, and all immunities, I should say, to some extent, is to keep these social workers who have extremely difficult, extremely controversial jobs, as anyone can see who reads the paper, from having to go to court and go through a jury trial and have a jury decide whether or not they were acting with due care. It's a Hobson's choice. The social worker in this case has the opportunity to either take the child out of the environment, take it away from his parents, take it away from its family, put it in foster care, or provide services of some point, which occurred numerous times, but leave the child in the home.
So what is, just in sort of here just to describe without reading it, 4B, what is that immunity meant to go to, the RMMA immunity?
Well, there's two, as I said.
Good. I see the words of it, but...
Good faith and due care.
Because that seemed, the policy argument you're making would also suggest, well, then why do we have this? You have to go to a jury on whether you exercise due care.
Due care is a negligent standard.
Right, so you don't get the immunity under here unless you were negligent. So, the policy argument you're making of... For social workers, it seems like that would also undermine even having RMMA immunity. But obviously, the legislature you know, thinks you get that immunity only if you've act in good faith and exercise due care with respect to that specific immunity. I'm trying to figure out how that fits in with the official immunity argument, the policy argument.
Well, again, I believe there are over, I'm out of time.
You can answer the question, okay. Mr. Andrew.
I think there are overlapping immunities, as I've stated before. Oftentimes, these cases are decided on multiple immunities for multiple reasons. And the point of it is to shield governmental employees. And remember, we only let the government do the hard things that ordinary people aren't going to do, from having to answer in court for their actions constantly unless some sort of standard is broken. I think official immunity needs to continue in order to accomplish that goal.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 5 minutes of rebuttal, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Your Honor. First rebuttal point is the allegation there is no evidence of causation. The plaintiff submitted an expert affidavit from Ms. Powell that outlined evidence of critical, of saying that the actions of these workers were below the standard of care, they did not use due care, and that there was causation. And specifically with respect to the sheriff's reporting, she testified by affidavit, in her experience, once the reports start rolling in, even a sheriff's office that might be reluctant at first to get involved in a case will take a different look at it if there are multiple reports going on. As to Polk County and the allegation
That happened a year before, all the reporting stopped a year before the incident actually happened. So you've got a significant time gap there. In addition, you have the report from the sheriff basically saying that, you know, we're not going to be even looking at those. And so, I mean, while it's certainly disconcerting that the reporting did not take place as required by the statute, the leap to causation seems incredibly large.
There's 2 points I offer in response to that. One is there's testimony from the people that were making the reports, the ones that for 18 months to 2 years had been making reports and saying this is a problem, you need to protect this child. And they were, and as one of them testified, at a certain point I threw up my hands. What's the use? All right. And then as to the sheriff deciding, making a decision, it gets back to the point. Do they have the power to tell the legislature, we don't like that law you passed. We get to pick and choose. That's what their position is. Polk County says they get to pick and choose which laws they follow and which ones they don't.
Right, but I think it's still speculative as to whether or not they would have taken action. We don't know whether or not they would have.
Well, it's a more likely than not standard. A causation is almost always a question for the jury, and we have put evidence in that joins the question for the jury. These would be good arguments to a jury. Hey, we didn't get any more reports, or the sheriff might not have acted on it, or the sheriff would have referred it back to us. That's not for a judge to make. And that's we've gotten into this. I've seen it over a number of cases where we start, unfortunately, the district courts are putting the appellate courts in the position of saying causation is a legal matter, and only in the most rare circumstances should it be a legal matter. And especially when we have a county sheriff saying, I'm not going to follow the law.
I appreciate that there would be challenges, no doubt, by the trustee with respect to the screening in and screening out decisions. But just as a matter of the way the law works, what needs to be under the law cross-reported? Is it reports that are actually screened in and found to be reports of maltreatment?
2 points.
Or all of the reports, irrespective of outcome?
2 points. The version of RMMA that applies to the county in this situation has at subdivision 10.1 that they shall conduct an investigation on reports. And so that we think that has moved into the report, this idea of they can make or not make a report. But we do know that they are supposed to cross-report, as I read the statute. When they get a complaint, they're supposed to, and they start to act on it, they're supposed to refer it over to the sheriff so that dual investigations can occur.
Okay, so even if there's no finding of maltreatment by the social services, they need to, before that, have forwarded the report to law enforcement.
And that makes sense when the legislature's saying, we want to bring all the resources to investigate so things don't fall through the cracks, given the policy.
So your argument is that every report that came in, even those that were screened out, needed to go to law enforcement?
Yes, they needed to come. And further, to take it a step back, we think every report that came in automatically moves to judgment under the due care standard, under the RMMA. whether or not they were using, whether or not they were acting negligently or not. So the RMMA is saying the minute that report comes in, we're now governing this. And it's you've identified the policy decision. Opposing counsel actually identified it fairly well. There's one view of immunities, and that is we're going to protect the county or the municipality and the worker from any suit, okay? We don't want them to have to face any suit, so we're going to have some immunities that are looking at the nature of the conduct, okay? The legislature here has said this is an important enough policy, and their public policy is clear in the beginning of the statute. This public policy is important enough that we're going to take it out of the, we're going to throw cases out on the front end, and they are matching it up with 466.03 subdivision 5 and the statute, and they're saying this one is going to be due care, and we're going to have courts look, we're going to have juries look at these issues. We're going to have trials.
Saying every time a social service agency gets a call that they don't exercise discretion on screening that call to determine whether or not it constitutes child maltreatment, because the statute seems to put that burden on them. It seems like, I can't imagine the legislature would have intended that, Mr. Peterson, that every time Hennepin County gets a call from someone that says, you know, I think something's going on next door and I'm concerned about these kids, without any specifics, that they got to then send that to the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, or that they're under some obligation to, on a vague report, conduct an investigation, that they're going to be judged on a due care standard. I can't imagine, with the volume of calls that must be received, that that's what the legislature intended.
Well, the HI and J govern what's intended, and I'm always reluctant to, when the question comes, will it always be reported? You'd have to look at the nature of the report and nature of what's going on. And it does have a, you know, it does have a factor of, you have to look at this, at the how substantial the report is as an initial threshold of dealing with the RMMA. Mm-hmm. The bigger question is, and I would submit to you that opposing counsel's right, that if you look at this, it's really hard to say at what point they're not exercising some professional judgment. And so when you have this, and the legislature has stepped in and said, wait a minute, we want a due care standard. They're not completely liable without some immunity. They have immunity. If they can show they were acting reasonably under the circumstances, they'll be immune.
Can I ask?
And I'm out of time, but I'm happy to answer whatever
question.
Certainly
there seems to be a couple of interesting questions that want to be asked, and I'm not going to permit, or I'm not going to say my colleagues can't ask them. So we'll start with Judge Smith.
Is immunity just the same as winning on liability and negligence, then?
Essentially, it is.
Okay.
Except with it is. Because the legislature has said, you know, unless you're negligent, we don't want to hold you liable.
Okay.
So a good analogy is to the trespasser statute, where it doesn't say there's an absolute immunity for a county if somebody trespasses on land. For normal negligence, for premises liability for a municipality, they get not a blanket immunity, but they enjoy the more difficult or higher proof standard of the trespasser statute, even if the person isn't a trespasser. And that in that way, they're saying, we are going to be trying, this is going to be an immunity that might not play out or not might not be available till after the trial, where we determine whether or not there's liability under the trespasser statute. And Judge, if I may, you asked about the Urban case. And that is a case where court looked and said, we have the common law concept of respondeat superior. We have a statute, all right? We can't allow respondeat superior to be applied here. It's abrogated by implication. So this is an exercise that has to happen. And I think, as I suggested earlier in the argument, State v. Ballou does provide a good framework for looking at it.
I think we've gone beyond the answer. Hold on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Judge Reyes might have a question.
I want to follow up on Judge Flory's point, because that is something that is very disconcerting to me in terms of the potential arguments. First of all, I think you're arguing that the RMMA completely abrogates common law, correct?
I don't want to say it completely does, okay? I think you have to look at it on a case-by-case basis like they did in Ballou.
Well, then are you saying that the two can coexist side-by-side? Because that sounds like a different argument than you made in your brief.
What I would suggest to you is that we can't imagine a situation. We've been trying to think of a situation where it could exist side by side, and we don't see it.
Well, I can think of several.
Okay.
Okay, I mean, if you look at the language of the common law, it says it provides a public official charged by law with duties when called for the exercise of his or her judgment or discretion is not personally liable to an individual for damages. But in your brief, on page 29 of your brief, you argue that the statute allows courts to second-guess a child protection worker's conduct. First of all, it sounds incredibly extreme. Second of all, that seems to be saying that the common law would never apply, which seems to be, in other words, the two cannot coexist side by side. And, you know, I when the language is clear, we seldom get into policy, but that seems to be something that would be very, very chilling for social workers that are out there trying to make very difficult decisions as to, as Judge Fleury said, whether to report it or not, or what, you know, what exactly to do in these situations. These are not easy situations. So I'm concerned about the idea of abrogating that common law protection that's provided, especially when you've got cases that still continue to recognize a common law immunity.
The problem with the analysis of allowing common law official immunity to come in is, as we experience, if you have discretionary acts and it's a front-end immunity, that is, it's to protect you from any kind of scrutiny or suit, okay, it's something they can bring early on to say, look, this person's making discretionary decisions, they're protected, period. No more, and that's kind of a separation of powers. The courts are saying, we're not going to get into judging them. Here, the legislature answered your question. It's not the plaintiff suggesting it. It's the legislature that answered the question. The legislature said, as counsel said, we have two types of immunities. We got the front-end ones, where the courts aren't going to look at the conduct at all. And then we have the due care standard. When the legislature imposed the due care standard, by implication, by necessary implication, they said, you know what, we can no longer look at these types of cases on the front end. We have to look at them with the due care standard in mind. And the social workers aren't without protection if they act reasonably, and it's reasonable under the circumstances. I think most jurors and most courts are going to recognize that under many circumstances, it can be reasonable care with a bad outcome, right? We suggest to you this particular case, it presents a different fact pattern. But the legislature has answered that question.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. And that concludes our calendar today. We appreciate your briefing in this matter, counsel, and your arguments here today. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue a decision within 90 days. We stand adjourned.
Thank you, Your Honor.
No, I'm just saying, okay.